The government is in a position to end this case and to free them.
Myanmar convicts two Reuters journalists for Rohingya coverage. It's Tuesday, September 4th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Please join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China offers investment and promises less debt for Africa. Massive weddings without the cost. Chinese farming in the United States. Rohingya newborn health and tracking animal species. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The U.S. sharply condemned the conviction of two Reuters journalists in Myanmar and their seven-year prison terms for violating the country's secrecy laws, calling it deeply troubling and a major setback in the Southeast Asian country's efforts to promote democratic reforms. The U.S. Embassy in Myanmar, also known as Burma, said the clear flaws in the case against the journalists, Wah Lone and Chaw Su, raise serious concerns about the rule of law and judicial independence in Myanmar. The two were covering the brutal military campaign in Rakhine State that has driven nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims across the border into Bangladesh since last August. They were focused on the massacre of 10 Rohingya by police and soldiers in the village of Indin. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Reuters editor-in-chief Stephen Adler about the verdict.
I was very disappointed with the verdict because there was really no evidence against them. All of the evidence suggested that they were innocent and that it was a blatant setup. So it was really upsetting and, though not surprising, because the fact that they were arrested and the fact that they were charged suggested that they were going to be convicted, because there was no evidence at any stage of the proceeding. There was no due process. There was no rule of law. So it was not that surprising that they were then convicted.
But this, everybody is saying, served as a possible statement that they were freeing things up as far as their government was concerned.
The fact that they were arrested under these circumstances, and we now know the arrest was a setup. A police captain testified at the trial that they had been instructed to provide documents to these two reporters and then to arrest them with the documents and claim that they had secret documents. And I think the goal was to stop them from reporting, but also to deter other journalists from looking too closely at what was going on.
Do you expect this to have a chilling effect on journalism, or do you think it might be the opposite?
It certainly isn't having a chilling effect on us. Even since they've been in prison, we published the story that they were working on that the government clearly didn't want published. And we've written four or five other, I think, very important investigative pieces in Myanmar. And I noticed that the global press is very much involved in covering what's going on there, covering what's happening in the refugee camps in Bangladesh. So I am concerned about the chilling effect on journalism in Myanmar. But I'd also note that reporters there have backed Wah Lone and Chaw Su very strongly. They've come to court. They've rallied. They've demonstrated. They've worn T-shirts.
Have you been in touch with the two or any of them, either of them?
No, I'm not in a position from here to speak with them, but those of our staff who are on the ground see them as they come and go between the courthouse and the prison, and they've certainly spoken with them, and their families have spoken with them. And their spirits seem high. Wah Lone and Chaw Su came out of the court today and said they weren't afraid. They knew they had done nothing wrong, and they were committed to seeing it through.
What about their families? How are they holding up?
I think naturally their families are very upset. Wah Lone and his wife just had a baby girl, and Chaw Su has a three-year-old. So it's very hard on the families for the fathers to be separated not only from the wives but from these very young children. And the breakup of the families is one of the great tragedies of this. I think they're also holding up well.
Do you expect these prison terms to be fully carried out?
I certainly hope not. Our goal now would be to try very much to persuade and to bring about the a pardon or some sort of end to this. The government is in a position to end this case and to free them. And it would not in any way interfere with the court process because the process of the trial is over. We think that there's no time like the present to get them out. They've been in there for 9 months for doing absolutely nothing wrong except doing journalism in the public interest. So we very much don't want to allow a lot of time to pass. We see this as a matter of enormous urgency, and we hope people don't lose interest. sometimes in these situations, people are interested for a while, and then they move on to something else. But this is one where we need sustained interest so that Walon and Chosawu can go back to their families and go back to doing the jobs they are supposed to be doing.
Reuters editor-in-chief Stephen Adler speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. U.S. Ambassador Scott Marcil told VOA the verdict was sad for the journalists and their families, but moreover, he said, one has to ask whether this process will increase or decrease the confidence that the Myanmar people have in their justice system. The two journalists were arrested last December after meeting with two police officers at a restaurant in Yangon and given a stack of documents. They were charged with violating the Official Secrets Act, which was enacted in 1923 when Myanmar was called Burma and was under British colonial rule. Both men have denied asking for the documents. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. China pledges fresh $60 billion to Africa, says no political strings attached. China's JD.com founder returns to Beijing after U.S. arrest. Hope and caution as Kim Jong-un shifts to North Korea's economy. Cybersecurity becoming major concern for Vietnamese businesses. Taiwan officials offer aid to stop floods from entering pivotal elections. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. You'll also find them on our VOAnews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We continue with VOA Asia. China is hosting the two-day triennial forum on China-Africa cooperation in Beijing. It is the seventh such meeting. Africa is the recipient of billions from China's so-called Belt and Road Infrastructure Development Program. More than 50 African heads of state are in attendance. David Shin is a former diplomat and adjunct professor in international affairs at the George Washington University. VOA's Victor Beatty asked him if debt to China is a growing concern among these countries.
It is for some African countries, not all. It's 54 African countries. There are different debt situations in every one of them. There are several that, in fact, there are, I believe, five, according to the International Monetary Fund, that are now deeply indebted, and there are another 11 that are in strong threat of being deeply indebted. Now, not all of that debt, though, is with China. In fact, in most cases, most of the debt is not. It is with international financial institutions and other countries. China is the major debt holder in several of the countries. And in those countries, obviously, it is an issue of concern.
China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi told his African counterparts on Sunday that President Xi Jinping will use the summit as an opportunity to outline a specific vision on building a China-Africa community with a shared future and announce proposals and measures to strengthen China-Africa cooperation. What does he mean?
The whole concept of the shared future is one of the new mantras of the Xi Jinping administration. And I think that means different things to different people. There will be very specific agreements that come out of this meeting in Beijing, as has been the case with all of the previous FOCAC meetings. But the whole concept of the shared values between China and Africa is a little fuzzier, and I think it really is in the mind of the beholder.
China's clout, of course, has grown exponentially over the years. According to Standard Bank Group's Asia operation, some 300 companies account for a majority of China's business activity, but the region also has some 30,000 smaller Chinese firms that are of growing importance. Obviously, China is having a huge influence on the continent.
This whole question of numbers of Chinese companies in Africa is an interesting one. I'm familiar with the report that you cite, the Standard Bank report, and you're quite right. They do indicate that there are as many as 30,000 Chinese companies in Africa. This is an estimate. Others have looked at this, and they have lower numbers than that. Actually, the government of China has a substantially lower number than 30,000. But it's possible that if you include all the Chinese restaurants and acupuncture operations involving one individual, you may get up to a number of 30,000. And it is, you're quite right, has a very important impact upon the continent. There certainly are more Chinese companies operating in Africa today than there are American companies.
David Shin said China's military base in the Horn of Africa country Djibouti is the first outside of China and clearly shows its growing security interest on the continent. At the same time, he cautions China's clout in Africa can be overstated. For instance, he said China only represents about 5% of all foreign direct investment in Africa, while that is dwarfed by the combined investments of European countries and, to a lesser extent, that of the United States. Still, China has become the continent's biggest bilateral trading partner. Happening now in Asia, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, who once compared himself to Hitler, paid a solemn visit to Israel's National Holocaust Memorial. Duterte, known for his profane outbursts, spoke quietly and respectfully, branding the Nazi leader insane as he lamented the Nazi genocide of an estimated 6 million Jews. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Every culture has its own traditions for wedding ceremonies. Some throw massive parties and invite hundreds of guests, while others enjoy the occasion with close friends and family. In India and Pakistan, weddings can be very costly, and ancient cultural traditions like requiring a dowry can prevent girls from getting married due to their family finances. Now a non-governmental organization in Srinagar, Kashmir, is helping Indian parents and couples lower the financial burden by organizing mass marriage events where over 100 couples tie the knot. VOA's Zubair Dar takes us to one of these joint ceremonies in this report, narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
Weddings in Indian-administered Kashmir have become very expensive, and a common problem for many Kashmiri families is simply not being able to pay for it. In a region where marriages are commonly arranged by parents, it is becoming more and more difficult for them to afford suitable life partners for their sons and daughters. Now, a local non-governmental organization called Jaffrey Council has found a way to lower the cost by organizing a massive wedding for many couples at the same time.
We noticed that folks had unmarried sons and daughters over 30. We thought we should work on this.
In a single event, 105 Kashmiri couples tied the knot. And much like traditional weddings, couples' guests were present and attendees enjoyed music as well as Kashmiri cuisine. Sayyid Tanvir Hussain thought it was the best way to start married life.
The marriage ceremony went really well. I think that everyone should get married the way we got married.
In Kashmiri culture, a bride is expected to come with a dowry, usually in the form of money or jewelry. Newly married Fatima says this event is not only helping couples forego the financial burden, it can also play a role in ending an ancient tradition.
What the NGO is doing is really good. At least for the poor people, it is really good. The dowry system must end. So many educated girls are still unmarried in that home only because they can't afford dowry.
The average cost of a wedding in the region can run between $30,000 to $40,000. But the Jaffrey Council asks each family to pay just $700 to participate in the joint ceremony. Couples tying the knot here say that they can enjoy the marriage more by not having the stress of starting their life together with a large debt. For Yusuf Jamil in Srinagar, this is Bejan Hamdad, VOA News.
Coming up, ancient Chinese farming takes root in the United States. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA programs. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia: two Malaysian women convicted under Islamic law for homosexuality were publicly caned Monday. The two unidentified women, ages 32 and 22, were punished in front of about 100 witnesses at a Sharia court. Human rights groups have expressed outrage about the verdict. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, in Minnesota, Hmong farmers have banded together to make a better living. Originally from China, the Hmong are an Asian ethnic group that migrated to Vietnam and Laos in the 18th century, but they have never had a country of their own. After the Vietnam War ended, many resettled in the United States, and now decades later, Hmong farmers are at the center of a local foods economy in Minnesota. VOA's June So has more in this report, narrated by Carol Pearson.
On a Friday, Mi Hang picks flowers to sell at a local farmer's market over the weekend. Mao Mua and her husband pick vegetables, also for a farmer's market.
We bought corn, sweet potato, then got cherry, cucumber, snap pea, had a little bit of cherry tomato, that's all.
Hang and Mua's families were among a mass exodus of Hmong people fleeing Laos for Thailand in the 1970s. Ever since they resettled in the U.S., they have been farming in Minnesota in recent years on a membership farm.
I like farming on the Hafa farm because this is a Hmong association. There are Hmong workers who help us. They are like our hands, eyes, and ears. I like there is also water, electricity, and the food hub.
So happy.
Since 2011, the nonprofit Hmong American Farmers Association, also known as HAFA, runs the 63-hectare farm outside St. Paul, Minnesota. Member farmers have a long-term lease on 2 to 4 hectare parcels to grow their vegetables and flowers.
One of the reasons why HAFA was created was because the Hmong farmers were experiencing so much uncertainty, but they didn't always have access to land. So when you don't have land tenure or land certainty, you can't actually invest in organic certification. You can't invest in perennials, which actually have higher profit margins.
Paco Hang was born in a refugee camp in Thailand and came to the U.S. with her parents in 1976.
During the Vietnam War. In Laos, my father joined actually a secret army that was allied with the United States CIA. But when the Vietnam War ended and the communist faction came into power in Laos, they actually began to target Hmong soldiers.
With more than 60,000, Minnesota has the second largest Hmong population in the country.
Within the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, Hmong farmers make up about 50% of all produce growers selling at the farmers markets. The Hmong growers' participation in the farmers market has really revitalized the farmers market.
HAFA also operates an alternative markets program called Food Hub.
Our Food Hub is a place where we aggregate our HAFA farmers' produce, and then we distribute it and sell it to different institutions such as schools, co-ops, or restaurants. And then we also have a CSA program, or community-supported agriculture, that we have about 350 currently members that they get a weekly subscription of produce.
Hang says Hmong farmers have fueled a freshly grown local food movement.
Hmong farmers are major contributors to our local food economy and to our overall economy. I mean, studies have shown that they produce over $250 million in sales.
HAFA's business development programs help the farmers to get micro loans to buy tractors or new farming equipment. But Hang says all the programs are not just for income generation.
What we're really interested in, what we are focused on, is actually wealth creation. And not just intergenerational wealth, but community wealth.
For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Dakota County, Minnesota.
This news from VOA Asia. Beijing is pledging to extend new funding of $60 billion to Africa, aimed at areas from industrial enhancement to infrastructure. China also says it will wipe clean the debt for certain African countries when interest-free loans come due later this year. Your free visit to VOA Asia Facebook will yield a wealth of knowledge. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, maternal and infant health is an ongoing concern in the Rohingya refugee camps, where poverty and a lack of education can create health risks for new moms and their babies. Steve Sanford has this update after traveling with mobile health workers in the camps.
Every week, about 50 babies are born into dire conditions, with less than a quarter of deliveries completed in proper health facilities. Traditional norms and limited education have left many mothers with little knowledge of basic sexual and infant health care. Vital nutrition begins at birth, but many mothers are often unable to breastfeed because of stress and the consumption of poor food quality.
The child's condition today is getting better. We gave meds and nutritional food, and afterwards we measured the body, and there is growth. It's better than the first checkup. The child was in terrible condition when we first checked.
The mobile health workers also counsel young women about taboo sexual health issues, such as menstruation and contraceptives. During their first period, Rohingya girls are confined to their huts, and costly hygiene pads are not always available.
We have to use a clean rag to clean ourselves during our period, and after we finish, we then wash it out in a toilet.
But there are also new ideas that some of the experienced moms plan to pass on to their children.
The elderly tell us not to eat birth control pills or medicine to stop us from producing children. They say it's a sin to stop birth. We listen to them, and that's why we had more children in our family. But now we realize that it's not a good idea to have many children. Now I teach my children not to have more children and use birth control.
With the newfound knowledge of better hygiene, nutrition, and birth control, the next generation of Rohingya at least have a better understanding to face the future. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
Scientists are always looking for new ways to do things. They found one to track animal species without having to capture them. Through a process called environmental DNA, scientists can now obtain the genetic trail animals leave behind, and that could help to protect and save threatened species. VOA's Deborah Block tracks the details.
Scientist Mark Stokel is throwing a bucket into New York's East River to learn more about the fish that live there. But he's not trying to catch fish. He's hoping to gather the tiny bits of DNA fish leave behind. Then he puts the water into plastic bottles for a closer look in the lab for what he calls environmental DNA.
We can collect the water sample, analyze the DNA, learn what fish are there.
Stokel and his students are trying to find out if the fish are recovering in the East River, which used to be extremely polluted. In the water, they find scales and skin cells, which leave behind genetic material.
A cup of water, you get what looks like a little bit of dust in the water. We extract that DNA, and then we analyze it the same way they do for a crime scene.
On the other side of the world, in a river in Vietnam, the hunt is on for the Yangtze soft-shelled turtle, a very rare species found only in parts of Asia.
We can be able to use environmental DNA as a forensic tool when we can't see animals, or if they're very elusive species. We can use capturing environmental DNA to be able to determine if those species live in a particular area.
Especially in unexplored waterways.
So that we could hopefully find additional undiscovered Yangtze giant softshell turtles to be able to help recover the species from the brink of extinction.
Knowing the microscopic trail animals leave behind may someday help scientists save other endangered animals from extinction. Deborah Block, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us online, iTunes and SoundCloud, our VOA Asia Facebook stream, and, of course, our website. Always a good place to get our program, as well as the many other great programs that VOA produces. That would be voanews.com. We also have great people here who produce our programs, including director Tracy Carter, engineer Greg Burns, our managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Please write to us if you can. VOA Asia at voanews.com is our address. We'd love to hear from you. Have a great day. We'll see you again tomorrow.